You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwanong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. I'm asking the universe to show me what it's got. Show me how it gets better. I trust you. I'm so grateful for the wonderful gifts. I'm humbled and amazed. I'm a servant to chronicle my life in collaboration with the natural flow of the universe. And perhaps tell the reader that they are not alone. I'm here to tell you, life gets better. My understanding of details gets deeper. I'm calmer, or at least I know now that communication of my feelings is key to being calmer. Even just writing my thoughts out into a string of words distances me enough from the thinking to recognize that it's not me. I recently saw the movie The Taking, and it was a surprise to see. I was turned into a fan of director Alexandre O'Philippe since the brilliant Lynch Oz, which transformed me and fired me up to edit and compose the Me movie. It hadn't occurred to me to look up more of his work. According to the film's description on Letterboxd, The Taking is a follow-up to his acclaimed documentaries on Psycho, Alien, and The Exorcist. I'm like, what? Needless to say, I have to watch them all. The Taking is arguably a first-person film, even if it mixes different voiceovers. Philippe doesn't bother to identify them for the audience, yet it seems to him important to identify each clip like an academic visual citation, essayistic in a cinematic an emotional way, as opposed to being newsy. It's unlike typical mainstream journalism and edges closer to a poetic performance of research through media composition. Philippe's audiovisual research on the representation of Monument Valley in cinema and television is presented as a seamless stream of visual examples to complement the wall-to-wall voiceover. The understated score by John Hagel, in combination with the dreamy editing style by Dave Crawling, keeps the taking from becoming just another YouTube video essay. And I must admit that I will never see Monument Valley in the same way again. This film is a must-see on the big screen. A film about Monument Valley's representation in cinema begins in London after the Blitzkrieg attacks in World War II. For my film, a film about the cinematic autobiographical impulse and how it has affected me, it begins with an image of a TV and static. TV snow. The very first screen image that I remember seeing. Seeing static was like seeing the primordial soup from which images came. I remember trying to look closely at the screen to see if I can discern some kind of hidden stereogram, a visual message, a puzzle piece, a trick, an oracle within the writhing pixels. A voice buried under the din of zero. Channel zero. TV snow was the doorway to another dimension. It was a channel. I'm excited for the title Stranger Than Nonfiction, for a project about the fiction of documentaries, focusing on exposing techniques of organization, narrativization, and imagination of the real in self-inscribed cinema. Could this project also be used as a platform to break down and analyze filmic techniques for messaging through subtle semiotics in conspiracy videos? The alternate title that I thought of recently is Cinemy. It's also equally good. According to writer Catherine Lupton, Chris Marker had coined cinema verite. Cinema verite. A play, of course, on the term cinema verite by separating ma from cinema to change the common phrase's meaning from cinema truth to cine my truth. The new title, Cinemy, sounded even better to me. Lupton says, Le Joli Mai remains one of the key works of French cinema verite, although Marker was quick to rephrase it as cine ma verite, cine my truth. Jean Roach and Edgar Morin's Chronicle of a Summer is a quasi-scientific-sounding translation of Ziga Vertov's Kino Pravda, signaling that he had no intention of abandoning personal expression as a means of engaging with the world. The essay film might be defined as setting out to depict the process of thinking around a given subject. with all its attendant messiness, hesitations, and sudden insights intact, says Catherine Lupton. Elizabeth Cowie suggests that documentary is a kind of thinking that is the same, that is in the same order as poetry in making leaps of association. Syed says cinematic presence, again, to evoke Sobchak's phenomenology, lies in the medium's production of an animated presentation of representation through the audiovisual display of the subjective temporality of memory, desire, and mood. Syed continues, partly defined by the exposure of process through the performance of authorship, they figure in their films using not so much the expression of interiority as their physical presence to assert themselves as authors. The presence of an authorial point of view, says Syed, is a sensitive question in documentaries, something to be either downplayed or made explicitly, even if only for the sake of honestly admitting to the limitations of film's ability to reveal a reality. Yesterday, I asked the students at the lecture if they thought Agnes Varda's The Gleaners and I was more, quote, entertaining than Sans Soleil, because the first film stated its intention for the film more clearly than the latter. And if Sans Soleil did have a subtly stated intention, what could it be? Josh Sinenko asked me what I thought the answer might be, since no one had said a word after I spoke, and I responded with, perhaps Marker stated the problem clearly, after all, when he said he couldn't find an image to place after the image of happiness. The entire exercise was perhaps about editing and how we create meaning from it. Marker and Philip Hoffman are those who use manipulative techniques only to highlight them to reveal the trickery of movies. In Agnes Varda's The Beaches of Agnes, I saw a shot of her art project to film her friends with angel wings, and I connected this to my short film, This City Has Wings. The image of the three children walking in Iceland will eventually find a place in the edit at the end of the film. They remind me of Freya, Ada, and Ivy and Drayson. I must have footage of them that I can visually connect to Sans Soleil somehow. The fugitive allure of Sans Soleil's images owes much to the feeling that they are something more than simply records of places and events in the world. They are things that have been cherished and remembered by somebody, says Lupton. Marker is alert to memory and memory's self-serving distortions, but even more so to our deep human need for memory as a form of protection. A shield that keeps at bay the losses imposed by time, forgetting and forced obliteration, even as our emotional investment in memory exists in direct ratio to whatever absence brought it to being. Memory is not the opposite of forgetting, but its lining. This is why Krasnodar cannot find a place for the delicately flickering image of three Icelandic children that opens Sans Soleil until their hometown is destroyed by a volcano. The poignancy of the image only stands out against the blackness, the annihilation, the absence of the sun. The subjective documentary viewpoint, which Marker did so much to pioneer, is now the norm rather than the outrageous exception. Witness Agnes Varda's The Gleaners and I, Jonathan Coet's Tarnation, or Jeremy Tarn's marker-inspired Black Sun, among others too numerous to name. The Gleaners and I, directed by Agnes Varda, is at once about gleaners, paintings, particularly of gleaners, artists who use recycled materials for their artworks, professes Varda, like herself, who gathers images, impressions, and emotions. And gleaning in the dictionary has a figurative meaning as well, she says, to glean facts, actions, and information. And for forgetful me, what I've gleaned tells me where I've been. Watching the film reminds me of the importance of music or a repeated phrase in particular. There could be merit to deciding on a dance remix of a classical tune ahead of time, wherein the unadorned classical melody is used most often to train the audience's ears and then give them the remix as a surprise treat after it's burrowed itself in their memory. Original music is credited to Joanna Brustowicz, but it's difficult to separate what Agnes Varda herself shaped as a soundscape as the nimble editor of the film. At one point, the filmmaker behind the camera, Varda, says, "I forgot to turn my camera off." Thus, the dance of the lens cap. The viewer is treated to a minute of this dance, accompanied by jazz tones. Here, she is gleaning, or in today's parlance, upcycling, the wasted film. I am connecting this scene to my film Trying to Be Some Kind of Hero, during a sequence that evoked a bank robbery. The lens cap punctuated the glare of the outside brightness with its clack against the camera as it dangled, while the filmmaker slash bank robber walked into the building to retrieve a safety deposit box. The legacies of Left Bank Cinema and the essay film have become mutually intertwined. Thus begins David Oscar Harvey's paper, The Limits of Vococentrism. It's Chris Marker, Hans Richter, and the essay film. He writes about Chris Marker, Alain René, and Agnes Varda, who had overlap with the French New Wave, where it shared a common interest in exploring personal expression with cinematic signifying practices and advancing the aesthetic possibilities of the film form. Alexandre Astruc's 1948 manifesto, The Birth of a New Avant-Garde, La Caméra Stylo, was an influence. With this notion of the camera as pen, Astruc expressed his desire for a cinematic mode of signifying thought and personal expression. Engagements with essay film have utilized the camera stylo as a metaphor for a film form that articulates intelligence and an individual point of view, typically accomplished through voiceover. The concept of the camera stylo reminds me of the line in Birthmark that was used in the trailer. I am using the camera as a flashlight. Instead of a pen, it's a camera lampe de poche, or a camera flash, used to illuminate the dark parts of my inner basement. The making of Birthmark revealed a belief that had to be excavated and destroyed. Vococentrism is Michelle Chaillon's term for the cinematic soundtrack's prioritization of the human voice over sound effects and music. Their soundtracks are dominated in a range around the human voice and the very rhetoric of film, its framework. It's constructed by the logic and nature of the voiceover. Voiceovers interact with the film's codes, but there are other ways. The act of enunciation can be signaled in various formal and technical ways, including editing and other representational manipulations of the image. The author contends that just because it's not vococentric, it doesn't mean it's not personal essay film. Wordless essay films create a line of thought or contention through an engagement with the image. Harvey says a film expresses itself primarily through perception. In other words, what the film claims to perceive is its expression. It says what it says through its voice, heard or unheard. As Harvey describes it, a film that does not adopt voiceover does not lack voice. Its voice is simply less explicit. My engagement with the non-vococentric essay film draws attention to a cinematic voice cultivated outside the linguistic register. If we have John Ford for the Western and Douglas Sirk for the melodrama, says Harvey, then for the essay film, Chris Marker seems to have been implicitly elected as master of the form. Point in fact, the Hot Docs Film Festival in 2021 presented a program of films under a section they simply named Markers, named after Marker, to indicate the subgenre and describe it in their own words, quote, films that push the boundaries of the documentary form, unquote. As Harvey notes, Marker's filmmaking practices have come to typify the essay film. Documentary scholars were interested in locating and working with films deploying practices of semiosis that undermined epistemological mastery by relying instead on fantasy, memory, and the opacities of the post-structural subject. Harvey says Marker's work coheres around a strong personal voice, but the strength in this voice does not lie in its epistemological authority. Marker is aware of this as seen in the moment from his letter to Siberia, where he replays the scene many times, each with a different perspective, one that supports the communist state, one that is against it, and a final voice that aspires to objectivity. The sequence highlights the inability of each variation to tell the whole truth, constructing instead various versions of the truth, each with its assortment of predispositions which cast doubt on any objective or veracious documentary exposition within cinema. Marker's formal logic follows no lucid time, no lucid line of reasoning, and instead drifts along variegated strings of intellection. Kaja Silverman makes Marker Sans Soleil a centerpiece in establishing a theory of the cinematic look, about which she declared there should be more films of this kind. in the fourth edition of Michael Rabiger's directing the documentary, in the chapter called Developing Your Story Ideas, he included subjects to avoid that included, quote, any ongoing inhibiting problem in your life. See a good therapist. You won't find any solutions while trying to direct the film. As I wrote elsewhere, it pits Birthmark literally as a textbook challenge. It seems at once disheartening, but also compelling. How did I manage to get funding for this? My rebellious, always trying to be original nature is my machismo, perhaps. I am giving no fucks. I am stealing from this and that. My first thought to try to address this problem is to actually include a therapist in the film. Just to be scientific or the other perspective, to uncover layers to this Lester character. Rabiger also says, every film I have ever made has been about imprisonment and trying to escape. It was many years before I realized this. A colleague said that underlying all his films has been the search for a father. His own died when he was young. We are all marked in particular ways, and we are all deeply moved and motivated by this. Direct autobiography is usually inhibiting, but any of the analogs can be freeing and fascinating. About my film Birthmark, I wrote, by including other people's stories, it's not so solipsistic. Hanging the stories onto the more in-depth story of the filmmakers is the idea. The essay film, according to Ursula Beeman, as quoted by Onan, situates itself somewhere between the documentary video and video art. Essays, as conceptualized by Michel de Montaigne in his famous work from 1580, are approached as tentative efforts at finding the truth about something. Texts in which the essayist tries to figure out what he or she thinks about something based on personal experience. Montaigne says the essayist has a constant reassessment of his ideas. To essay, says Onan, is to assay, to weigh, as well as to attempt, suggesting an open-ended evaluative search, which is constrained by the presence of individual subjectivity. Onan cites The Gleaners and I by Agnes Varda, Kirsten Johnson's camera person, Chris Marker Sansoleil, as examples. The author says Theodore Adorno focuses on luck, the luck play and irrational characteristics of the essay, seeing them as fragmentary and wandering, as well as a form that does not seek to advance truth claims like the documentary genre's approach in the case of film. The voiceover, says the author, is a necessary dialogic component of the essay film. Far from being an example of didactic and authoritative voice of God commentaries, voiceover is a supple tool that linguistically uses effect to produce intellectual and emotional results, provoking reflection and establishing a dialogue with the audience. The image and the spoken word, says Onan, are expanded when the finished body of work has an audience. In Tokyo Ga, director Wim Wenders, in voiceover, questions concepts such as reality, dreams, or games, often asking questions or sharing his considerations. The author continues to say that the essay becomes a sort of inner speech, where the threads used by the essayists in their meditation are laid out in full view. Jean-Luc Godard sees the essay film as a form that thinks. He says the essay film is a puzzle of meanings, created by the filmmaker for the viewer to be resolved by taking part in the audiovisual experience through the received information. And of course, the essayist dialogue could only be reached when the right combinations are made with the editing. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwanong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. I found the intro to Cinema Movement's readings for this week really interesting. It gave me a lot of food for thought. It's right up my alley. In Why Are Ethical Issues Central to Documentary Filmmaking, the introduction to the second edition of Bill Nichols's Introduction to Documentary, he says, documentary engages with the world by representing it in three ways. A, documentaries offer us a likeness or depiction of the world that bears a recognizable familiarity, a fidelity. And this quality alone often provides a basis for relief. We see what was there before the camera. It must be real. It really existed or happened. But a verifiable, authentic images does not necessarily guarantee the validity of larger claims made about what the image represents or means. Remember the journalist that posted deep fakes of Russian spies as an exercise in post-truth? Documentaries also stand for or represent the interests of others. And C, documentaries may represent the world in the same way a lawyer may represent the client's interests. They may make a case for a particular interpretation of the evidence before us. I recall the jinx. After defining what it is, Nichols then moves to the ethics of representing others, which is the topic of the recent film called Subject 2022, directed by Jennifer Teixeira and Camila Hall. By interviewing subjects of well-known documentaries and examining what the impact of commercial success had on their participants. What do we do with people when we make a documentary? Should they receive compensation? Is it all right to have people repeat actions or conversation for the sake of the camera? These and many other questions are tackled by Subject. Nichols notes that people are treated as social actors rather than professional actors. Their everyday behavior and personality serve the needs of the filmmaker. And yet the act of filmmaking itself is not altogether unobtrusive. The observer often changes the observed. The author recalls an American family 1972, which raised debate about whether the family's behavior and their own family relationships were altered by the act of filmmaking or were simply captured on film. Paying participants would destroy the documentary tradition because it questions the motives of the filmmaker and the participant while making 12 with the NFB as per their suggestion. I found myself paying for gas, cigarettes, or dinner in order to gain the trust and goodwill of the people from whom I was extracting stories, images, and, as some believe, no less than their souls for the sake of the film. It's a courtship sweetened by a bigger budget. Nichols asks, should we tell someone we film that they risk making a fool of themselves, or that there will be many who will judge their conduct negatively? On the other hand, filmmakers who choose to work with people already familiar to them, says the author, face the challenge of representing common ground responsibly. The documentary Invisible Beauty, which premiered last month at the Sundance Film Festival, according to Justin Anderson, writing for Real Screen, erases the line between subject and filmmaker. The film started out being about the fashion industry, modeling, and includes Hardison, who is also one of the two directors, she says. I wanted to try to be as kind to the situation as possible, knowing that I am the subject, and to try to be as open as possible to try to stay out of my own way, stay out of Frederick's way, and just to be as cooperative as possible. The film was about the fashion industry during Bethann Hardison's time, and it eventually evolved to be about her and led to her being involved behind the camera as co-director with longtime acquaintance Frederick Chang, who was quoted as saying, when you're making a documentary about a subject, it's a big responsibility and it can be daunting. It can be stressful because you have your point of view and the point of view of the story, but the subject has their point of view on the story too, and that can become very tense in a way that I don't find necessarily productive. He continues, I wanted to reverse that from the beginning or start from a different point where the film would be a reflection of both our points of view, and the only way to do that was really to just be in constant communication and really talk about everything. Talk about our disagreements. And working so closely with Chang on how her story would play out on film allowed her to see herself. In Nichols' paper, he also mentions the controversy surrounding the inclusion of a scene in Hoop Dreams that showed Arthur, the principal subject, while his father is engaged in a drug deal in the background. The choice was approved by the family, including Mr. Agee, who was subsequently arrested in the recent subject. Arthur Agee is now in his 30s and talks to the camera again. Among other things, the film focused on the scene's inclusion and how the arrest transformed his dad into a responsible father. Nichols also writes about a film called No Lies, where a camera-toting man pressures a woman to talk about a rape, to comment on documentary film's potential abuse by turning people into victims so that we can learn voyeuristically about their suffering and misery. Filming trauma victims is very much frowned upon. Nichols concludes the chapter on various formulations of the relation of speaker/subject/audience. These formulations suggest what kind of relationship the viewer may have with the film by suggesting what kind of relationship we may have with the filmmaker and his or her subjects. In the type I speak about them to you, he includes first-person documentaries, which he qualifies as edging the documentary form toward the diary, essay, and aspects of the avant-garde or experimental film and video. He notes here that the emphasis shifts from persuasion to expression. This expressiveness remains coupled to representations about the social historical world, including the world as a social actor, going about his or her life, among others. Speaking about implies a content-oriented desire to convey information, rely on facts, and make points about the world we share. With it, speaks about them for or it to us, types. The documentary is addressed to us from a source that lacks individuality. An institutional discourse in which the film informs us about some aspect of the world in an impersonal but authoritative manner. And in the type I or we speak about us to you, the filmmaker and subject are of the same stock, and the author uses the same word I have used to describe my films 12 and Birthmark. It's wonderful to see my heroes' names, Alan Berliner, Intimate Stranger, Jonathan Coet, Tarnation, but I found it slightly distressing to hear Nichols mention other filmmakers whom I've not heard about before working in the same genre of cinematic self-inscription that I have devoted my life to studying. He talks about Marlene Booth, Yiddle in the Middle, Lisa Lawenz, Letter Without Words, and Camille Billops, Finding Krista, which all link the personal with the collective experience. Films I have to add to my watch list now, but how do I find them? Media archaeology urges me to dig, to excavate, and write counter-histories by remembering the forgotten past. Last week's guest speaker at the Personal Documentary Filmmakers Group Call, Stephanie Sonata, impact producer of the documentary Subject, had this to say.
I started in journalism, so I was always growing up really interested in storytelling, did all the writing classes I could, creative writing, nonfiction writing. I was part of the paper. And I also had a real interest in social justice and history. And so journalism kind of fit into that, you know, trying to find out truths, trying to, you know, see areas that I could make a positive impact. It wasn't until I graduated grad school, actually, that I thought about actually getting into, you know, filmmaking. And I thought, you know, the natural next step instead of just print journalism would be to, you know, see documentaries in the early 2000s that they were, you know, starting to trend upwards. So I thought that was really interesting. And that started to really kind of shape what I thought as a journalist. In journalism school, you're taught to be, you know, the objective observer, and you're just there to record history. And you're an outside person, direct cinema, you know, you fly on the wall kind of thing. But I lived in Chicago and interned at Cartoon Point Films, which some of you may be familiar with Hoop Dreams, Minding the Gap, a lot of those. And they really, Gordon Quinn was kind of my mentor and really kind of shook that out of me. Like, no, you know, they were doing things and saying things from like Hoop Dreams, paying for the family's electric bill. You know, I was like, as a journalist, I would have never thought of that. But it really forced me to rethink what colors and the power dynamics of documentary and nonfiction filmmaking. You know, I think we've all heard the, you know, old homage that, you know, history is written by the victors, and I had kind of understood that but didn't really live it until I started thinking about that. And then as my career, I've been in the industry for about 11 years now. As my career started to evolve, I've definitely gone away from, you know, that objective observer and started to really, really appreciate personal documentaries. I don't know if you've heard of Steve James's, he has a personal documentary called Stevie where he does insert himself into that. It's an early 2000s film. Really interesting ethics involved in that as well, so I would highly recommend that. But you know, after seeing that one, I was like, oh, there's whole other stories that can be told, and history does not have to be recorded by the objective observers and the victors. Like, we don't have to be, you know, participants in stories. We can actually start writing and telling our own stories, and I think that's where personal documentaries have such a power. And we're starting to see that there is a real need for that in this way. So I think that's important to have personal documentaries and even personal journalistic pieces as part of the, you know, canon in storytelling and in our society. We've seen the democratization of camera equipment. You know, when documentaries first started, film was expensive. Getting training to actually know how to use the camera and develop your own film was expensive and took a lot of specialized training. But now that anybody can have, you know, a camera in their pocket, I think is starting to see that there's a really, really powerful movement to do some really cool independent work. And I think that's a great thing for the industry and for society and for a lot of these conversations that are really important to help progress positive social change.
You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwanong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. Today's program is the final episode of the season. It's been a journey filled with joy and productivity. Check the show notes for links to more content and how to stay in touch. I'm L.A. Alfonso. Thank you so much for being part of this. Thank you so much for the various contributions of Max Mueller, Stephanie Sonata, Thomas Flight, Rick Cousins, Mark Aldwood, Ryan Purdon, Kevin Gallagher. Thanks to all my supporters. Thanks, extra special thanks to Trent University, Mike Epp, Jessica Marion Barr, Mike Munn, Josh Sinenko, Liam Mitchell, Hugh Hodges. Special, special thank you to Trent Radio and Jill Stavely. Thank you so much to all my readers and listeners, especially Troy Armstrong, Silas, who's listening now, David Howlett, Adam Begat, Paz Chook. And special, big special thanks to my biggest fans, my mom. Hi, Mom. Georgia, May, listening. And Sunny Paxton, I love you. I'm Ellie Alfonso. Thank you so much for listening. This is Synesthesia. Today's playlist includes work by Drones Over Dufferin from their albums Oral Obscura Volumes 1 and 2, Oliver Patrice Weeder, The Shoe Factory, William Tyler, Music from First Cow, Mark Junker, Prepared Piano 1.0, and Ambulette. Again, thanks for listening. I'm L.A. Alfonso.